Hey, before we get started with Real Science Radio, we have now officially begun our November 2021 telethon. We typically set a dollar goal like $30,000 or $40,000, but this time we're looking for 20 new monthly donors who will sponsor one show a month. Being on air, it definitely isn't cheap. We run about 20 broadcasts and it costs us about $150 per show. We operate on a shoestring budget, so in the past we've relied heavily on those large donations and big dollar telethons. But that was when Bob was here. Now the ministry has less security, and that makes promoting Bob's teaching a daunting task. So if you and just 19 others can help us guarantee that the show goes on, Bob's biblically centered teachings will go out to thousands more. The ministry of so many godly leaders, authors, and preachers have been magnified tenfold or even a hundredfold after their passing. Think of C.S. Lewis and how he still, today, has such an impact on millions. We have no doubt Bob could have a similar impact, and your sponsorship of just one show a month will be the force to magnify this ministry and the gospel. So if you can help and sponsor just one show a month, that would be a massive blessing. So just go to rsr.org, and at the very top, you'll see a banner that says Telethon. So just click on that banner, and you can sign up and sponsor a show. That would be incredible and such a blessing.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams.
And I'm Ryan Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
That's my line, Ryan. Welcome to the show. So you and Dom actually did a RSR program, I don't know, a couple of years ago. You were just out of college, and now you're 3 years removed from college. You gave quite the interesting experience with having to deal with the worldview of evolution that just permeates at least 90% of the students there. And also, we've got Creation Magazine, and I know you had a subscription to that when you were at college. And I think you said that you would read it and then you'd leave it like in the student campus buildings or different things like that.
Yeah, it's an honor to be here, first of all. And I would read them throughout college. It was a great asset, too, while I'm in the midst of being taught about, you know, evolution, hearing millions of years all the time. It was nice to also have the magazine as just another supplement to read while I was going through school. And yeah, I would just leave them around classrooms. I'd finish, hopefully. Maybe some student, maybe even a professor would pick it up and actually read it and hopefully not just throw it out a second after seeing it, but maybe it was able to help somebody else other than me.
Yep. You know, when I'm done with mine, a lot of times, like if I'm flying or something, I'll leave them in the airplane or leave them somewhere when I'm done with them and just hopes that, hey, maybe we'll find out in heaven someday that, you know, there's the handful of people actually picked it up and it had an impact. Well, anyways, we've got a great show in store for everyone. We like to say that RSR's most persuasive evidence for a biblical worldview of creation is the three Ds, dinosaurs, diamonds, and DNA. On this show, we're going to give you yet another feather in the cap for diamonds, which are already a creationist's best friend.
This one should be quite the gem.
Okay. We're going to get to this a little bit later in the show, so stay tuned for that. So again, we've got Volume 23, number 4 of Creation Magazine. It's always been our favorite creation publication. Okay, so we're going to get started. The first article I wanted to go through, super interesting. It's titled, Multicellular Animal Revived After 24,000 Years. So Ryan, do you want to read what this article starts off with?
Yeah, so there's a microscopic multicellular animal called a Deloid rotifer, and it was revived after being frozen, Han Solo-esque. But unlike Han, the scientist wasn't Jabba the Hutt. But this one was in permafrost for supposedly 24,000 years. It was recovered in northeastern Siberia after drilling 11 feet below the surface. Despite being the longest reported case of rotifer survival, when defrosted, it quickly went on to reproduce.
Wow. So this thing, it got to business right after being revived. That is incredibly amazing. So this comes from the journal Current Biology, and here's what Stas Malavan, one of the lead investigators, wrote. The takeaway is that the multicellular organism can be frozen and stored as such for thousands of years and then returned back to life, a dream of many fiction writers. He went on to say that the study showed that this animal had effective biochemical mechanisms of organ and cell shielding necessary to survive low temperatures. Now, of course, the researchers then bowed to their god of evolution. Instead of the obvious that this is a complex engineering mechanism from the creator, the god of Genesis.
The article then goes on to note that the rotifers would have been frozen in the permafrost towards the end of the Ice Age after Noah's flood, around 4,000 years ago, which is the truth of the matter, unlike the 24,000 conundrum from the original article.
Yes. And so regarding the, you know, we'll talk about both of those, you know, both that 24,000 year age and then, you know, regarding the Ice Age. So secular scientists have difficulty explaining how an Ice Age could begin because it requires generally conflicting conditions. You know, because if the Earth was warm, no ice would amass. And if the Earth was cold, insufficient evaporation would occur to produce continental blizzards. Ryan, you've read Walt Brown's Hydroplate Theory. In fact, you have his book, right?
I have. Truly fascinating book. He goes into talking about how the warm oceans and cold continents are a direct consequence of the Hydroplate Theory, where the fountains of the Great Deep flooded the Earth with hotter subsurface water, plus the friction from the Atlantic floor rising, the Pacific Ocean sinking, and the continent sliding all warmed the water even more. And the thickening of the continents raised them to great heights, making them cold, high enough elevation place to collect snow and ice from the heavy precipitation that resulted from the evaporation off the warm oceans. Then the ice melted as the continents slowly settled into the mantle, which then raised the sea level and got rid of the land bridges and left the continents as we have them today.
Yeah, and by the way, you can find out more about the Hydroplate Theory at rsr.org/store and get Bob's incredible video on the Hydroplate Theory. It's a 3-part video. It's really fantastic. Highly recommend it. And also, Brian Nickel has a tutorial on the Hydroplate Theory. So just to summarize, to have an ice age, you need warm oceans and you need like cold mountains, and that'll help you get an ice age. And the secular scientists, they can't come up with a really good reason of how they can have an ice age. So we also know that their 24,000 carbon date isn't accurate. We believe the Earth is roughly 6,000 years old. So this is obviously, it's great for them because they think, well, anything they can do to contradict Genesis. I mean, that's what this whole battle is all about. This date is inaccurate, and we can go to Walt Brown's book to learn about radiocarbon also. We have his book online, in fact. You can go to hpt.rsr.org, and his book is right there online, and you can go to that. So, Ryan, what do you know about carbon-14?
Yeah, so carbon-14 and its decay to nitrogen-14 is often used as a dating technique, and that's how these scientists got their supposed date of 24,000 years. However, the issue with these dates is that anything from before the flood can often be inaccurate just due to the many assumptions that go into the radiometric dating and dating with carbon-14.
Yeah, so basically the problem is you've got carbon-12 and carbon-14. There's a ratio, carbon-14 divided by carbon-12. So before the flood, you'd have all these lush forests that the flood would then bury. So before the flood, you had a lot more carbon-12. So the carbon-14 is going to be diluted. Well, if you're an evolutionist and you assume that the carbon-14 to carbon-12 ratio has been roughly the same through history, then if there was a flood, anything before the flood or trapped during the flood is going to give a much older carbon-14 date. So they're making an assumption, and we can explain why this thing is dating to something greater than 6,000 years. So you can go to Walt Brown's online book, and you can go to the section on carbon-14, or you can go to rsr.org/C14 and find out more about carbon-14 and really the additional problems it causes for evolutionists, but we'll get to that later.
All right, so moving on to the next article, it's titled Earth's Early Atmosphere, same as today's. And this one's the tease for the diamond one, so we know everyone's been excited about that. So recently, scientists analyzed tiny gas bubbles in diamonds said to be at least 2.7 billion years old. They concluded that the chemical composition of Earth's atmosphere was established early in its history.
So I really like this one. You know, because diamonds, they have an extremely tight lattice structure, and they're ideal as time capsules. So here they find that diamonds exhibit the same properties of our current atmosphere, not the one that, you know, evolutionists like to say is, you know, this original atmosphere was all carbon dioxide and it was devoid of oxygen. That's what they want you to believe with how the Earth started. But here's what the lead researcher of this article said. And again, you're right, Ryan. This is the one we mentioned at the start of the show. It's another gem, another feather in the cap for creationists as far as diamonds are concerned. So Dr. Michael Broadley of the University of Lorraine, he said, this was a surprising result. So I think we need to add this to our list of shocked evolutionists. If you go to, you can go to rsr.org/shocked. And Bob and I did a show on just all the quotes we get from evolutionists whenever they discover something that they don't expect. And they're always either amazed or shocked or surprised. One guy, he called the discovery horrendous. When they found out that the Y chromosome, when they looked at the chimp Y chromosome, it was 30% different than humans. And the scientist said, that's horrendous. Of course, that's not a scientific term. Yeah, it's not. That's definitely a religious term. They don't like what they're finding out. And so again, this guy here says, this was a surprising result.
Yeah, shocker. Luckily, while it's surprising to them, it's not surprising to us. And the Focus article continues on to say, however, this is no surprise to those who believe the creation account in Genesis, that the earth was created to be inhabited, Isaiah 45:18 for reference. God created the world in six normal-length earth rotation days about 6,000 years ago. He began creating plants on day three, so obviously the atmosphere needed to be in place by then, with a composition much like today's, so the creatures could breathe.
Yep. So, yes, we know that diamonds would have formed during the creation week in the basement rocks miles beneath the surface. I mean, secular scientists agree that's where diamonds come from. But we believe in a global flood. There's tons of evidence for it. And the flood would have brought these diamonds to the surface. In fact, this is super interesting. We even find some diamonds in meteorite fragments. Bob and I did a show on this back in 2018. It was one of those Walt Brown was here or all scientists work for Walt Brown discoveries. So again, we've got this great piece of evidence now for diamonds having the same material as Earth's early atmosphere. Well, in our case as a biblical creationist, yeah, it has the same composition as we'd expect to find today. So the other thing we've mentioned many times about diamonds and why they're a creationist's best friend is the fact that you find carbon-14 in them. And you talked earlier, Ryan, about carbon-14, how it decays into nitrogen. It only has a half-life of 5,700 years. So after, say, 50,000 years, you shouldn't be able to find any carbon-14 in anything on the Earth if the Earth is billions of years old. Yet we find it all over the place, including the hardest substance known to man, which are diamonds. We find carbon-14 and diamonds that are mined from miles beneath the Earth's surface. It's amazing. It's a totally powerful argument for the literal view of creation from Genesis, and that's why it's one of the big three Ds that we like to talk about: dinosaurs, diamonds, and DNA.
Yep, that is great. That's phenomenal. The next article we were going to go through is yet another archaeological confirmation of the Bible titled Early Alphabetic Writing Found in Israel. So I'm just going to read a little excerpt from it. A long-standing challenge by Bible skeptics is that writing was supposedly not sufficiently developed in Moses' day for him to have composed Genesis through Deuteronomy. But a newly discovered pottery sherd supports the opposite case. Archaeologists unearthed the 4x3.5 cm fragment at Lachish, Israel, one of the most important cities for Judah and much of its history. The sherd displays just 6 letters, written in a Semitic script closely related to the Hebrew script used later during Israel's monarchy. 2 words can be identified: slave and honey.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, the article goes on to say that this find indicates that the alphabet spread to the region of Israel a couple of centuries earlier than previously established. This, of course, is consistent with the biblical testimony that many common people in Moses' time could write, or at least had access to those who could. And you can reference Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 through 9, and chapter 24. So I'll just read Deuteronomy 6 real quick. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. Evolutionists, Ryan, they've never been able to explain where languages come from. So we did a show back in 2009, and we'll reference it on the website for this show. And you can listen to it by going to rsr.org/language. We presented the conclusions of some of the world's leading linguists that primitive languages do not exist and no evidence of the evolution of language has ever been found.
Yeah, that's an extremely powerful argument for creation and against evolution, because how can evolution even bring up an alphabet, let alone a whole language? There's no real way to get there through series of random mutations. There's no real way to explain that. And that's one of the many pesky problems that trips up evolutionists, is the alphabet, language. And that verse you referenced is just super cool, how early in the Bible, God's telling the Israelites to write his words and write these things down for future generations. It's just really cool stuff. And now it's helping us, a long distant future generation.
And this, again, gets to the whole problem of information. And, Ryan, you're a software engineer. You're working at with your paw there at Micron. So you see how information works. You have a computer language that you program in. You're programming in C right now, and I know you've done C# and C++. Well, that language, that computer language, has symbols, it has syntax, and it has meaning attached to it, just like the Hebrew, the original Hebrew language, or our English language. How does that itself evolve? There's just no way, because evolution, they believe things happen by random mistakes. Let's not forget that. They rely on mistakes and then some blind selection process to then push evolution forward. How can they even ever get to the point where evolution could create information, create a language of symbols, meaning, and syntax? You know, I kind of view it, one way to look at it is, if somebody writes SOS on a beach, that's information. That's saying help. That's a symbol, and people recognize that. By mistakes happening or wind or erosion, you're just not going to get anything that looks like information. And ultimately, that's what they have to rely on, and it just doesn't work. Information has always been a powerful argument, a very powerful argument against evolution. And Ryan is a software engineer. I mean, how could... Even if you're an engineer, how could you look at this and not know that there has to be a creator? Yet people will still deny the truth because they, you know, because of their pride, they're in rebellion. They hate God.
Well, it's crazy too with the software languages, because not only does the language provide information, like a DNA code, for example, and in software, just like in people, in the DNA. Hopefully, if you type a word wrong or have a typo and missing letter, it'll just not work. But oftentimes, it's even worse, and it causes it to work incorrectly, and it ends up being super hard to track down. But even beyond that, how does the language even exist in the first place? It'd be as if these programming languages just arose from nothing without some person. I wish I could remember who created the C language, but it'd be as if that person never existed, and that language, along with all the other ones, just arose out of nothing.
Yeah, what a great point. And so you're saying, Ryan, you're telling me that if you've got a bug in your software that didn't improve the program, you can't just leave it in there and hope that the program gets better?
Nah, it'd make my life a lot easier, but unfortunately, that's not the way it works, yeah. And I don't want to get fired.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, the next article is pretty interesting in itself. It's called Animal Adoptions Make No Evolutionary Sense. So, Ryan, you want to give us an idea what that article is all about?
Yeah, so this one's really interesting. It talks about how different species of animals basically adopt other species of animals. This one gives the example of how a lioness adopts a baby oryx. and a leopard adopts an infant baboon, which is just kind of remarkable that these completely different species, if it's all about survival, they should be taking the opportunity to kill the infants abortion-esque. But instead, they just take it as their own and raise it, which is really cool.
Yeah, so there's another example here. In captivity, pigs were suckling tigers. I mean, that's... I always wondered, when I saw that one, it was like, wow, I wonder what happens as they get older. Is that kind of a dangerous situation? You know, some people like to joke that Noah made one mistake when the ark landed. He let the unicorns off first, and then right after that, the lions and the tigers. Or maybe the single cat kind. Anyways, this article really is cool. It goes on to say, of course, we enjoyed pointing out that such behavior from an evolutionary framework makes little sense. And it still doesn't, as per the title of a recent article by evolutionists from Bangor University, and that was titled, Animal Adoptions Make No Evolutionary Sense, So Why Do They Happen? The authors tried to come up with possible evolutionary explanations for cats adopting ducklings and many other instances of altruism beyond kinship, and that's quoting them. But the crux of the matter, in their own words, remains, quote, adoptions like these puzzle biologists. From an evolutionary perspective, what matters is how many copies of your genes make it into the next generation.
Another shocker, it sounds like to me.
Yeah, exactly. So the article goes on to say, from the perspective of biblical history, however, animal adoptions and other evolution-defying examples of suppressed carnivory are a beautiful echo of a pre-fall world without death or pain. Also, a reminder of the biblical prophecy of such a time to come, which comes from Isaiah chapter 11, verse 6, and chapter 65, verse 25. Ryan, do you have those handy?
I do. Isaiah 11, 6 says, the wolf also shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them.
Wow. And then do you have Isaiah chapter 65, verse 25?
The wolf and lamb shall feed together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord.
Wow. So once again, scientific evidence always fits the Bible, and this is yet another example. So the next article is sharks use Earth's magnetic field to navigate. That is super cool. We've talked about how animals use the magnetic field. This is just another example. And Ryan, what does this article have to say?
Yeah, this article's pretty cool. It just talks about how sharks are able to use Earth's magnetic field to direct them. It's like they are Google Maps. They can use the magnetic field to navigate through the extremely dark ocean when there's not much to see, but they still always get to where they're going, even if they have to travel hundreds of miles. And maybe they got lucky, like evolution would say, how they came about, but I think that was planned and designed.
The research paper stated this, navigating thousands of kilometers to a target location through a three-dimensional ocean is among the most impressive feats in nature. The sharks must first have built-in biological hardware to detect the field. Then they need sophisticated programming or software to use it to navigate. For humans, the same feat would require high intelligence, learning, and directed application. You know, unsurprisingly, the paper credited undirected evolution for these amazing abilities, rather than the obvious that it was from a supremely intelligent designer, the God of the Bible. So, you know, again, how in the world, what kind of fantasy picture can they try to paint of how this navigation built-in system, it's referred to as built-in biological hardware by the authors of this paper. How can they say that that can happen naturalistically? Again, evolution relies on mistakes and unguided natural selection, a blind process. It just can't happen. Again, one of the many examples, these hammerhead sharks, of how they use the magnetic field and they have to have built-in hardware to navigate it. It's just simply amazing. There's also an article, Ryan, in this magazine later on. It's not in the focus section, and it's on how bats actually can see the magnetic field, and that is super cool.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff, and yet another example of where programming and information comes into play for an animal. And another interesting thing about this one is it's also yet another chicken and the egg problem for evolutionists. What came first, the hardware or the software? Because they both have to be there at the same time. So say the hardware exists, but the actual information to be able to use that to navigate where it wants to go. Without the information, it'd be worthless. But also without the actual receptors and the capability to detect these magnetic fields, even if you know where to go and know how to use them, it's still overall worthless and, you know, a waste because it would still have no value. Not to mention the fact that without this, all sharks would die. So who knows how they even made it those little steps to get there without dying, since they need to reach these locations in order to survive and reproduce.
Yep. Great point, Ryan. So again, chicken and egg problem. It's huge for them. They need the hardware to start with. That's already an amazing feat. And then they need the programming language, the information to make this all happen. And, you know, information has been one of our favorite topics. It's really part of the three Ds. When we talk about dinosaurs, diamonds, and DNA, the whole reason the biggest problem with DNA is it's information. It's a programming language. In fact, DNA is so remarkable, and the RNA, that you can read it backwards and you get a different set of programming instructions. Truly amazing. In fact, you can even read DNA three-dimensionally and you get information. Try to write a computer program, Ryan. Just think about that. You know, the way the whole thing works, you got a processor and that it reads instructions. It has a program counter and reads instructions from memory. And then it acts on that software that somebody wrote, intelligence wrote, to then perform some function. Maybe it just simply turns on a light on a user interface, whatever it does. But then imagine writing a program that when you read that machine language backwards, you know, you compile your C into what's called a machine language that the processor understands. Now read that memory backwards and it does a totally different function. Maybe it makes light a different color. And that's how the DNA works. It's amazing. It could regulate maybe how long to keep the light on. A different strand of DNA read a different way, say three-dimensionally, may tell it, oh, let's produce this much protein, this amount. And if that stuff's wrong, if that program's wrong and you produce too much, you say a certain protein, well, that could be very harmful to the organism. So once again, there's no way evolution can explain this. From Romans 1, it says, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen by the things that God has made, so they are without excuse. They won't be able to have any kind of excuse on Judgment Day with all the promoting they've done of evolution and trying to feed this lie to a gullible public that somehow evolution is real and it can create these amazing structures like this hardware and this software and this shark that can navigate great distances through 3D space.
Yep, this level of programming, have a code that says one thing one way and another way backwards, makes prodigies like Zuckerberg and Bill Gates look like chumps.
true enough. So, you know, in fact, didn't Zuckerberg, he wants to rename Facebook. I just read about that here in the news last couple days ago.
Yep, he's changing it to Meta, I guess, because...
Meta?
Yeah, it's some like cryptocurrency, crypto art thing that people are falling in love with. Has something to do with that. Maybe we can talk about that on RBR, Real Business Radio.
We actually have time, I think, for one more article in this wonderful Creation Magazine. Once again, we're in Creation Magazine. It's volume 23, number 4. Highly recommend it. Great magazine. Comes out, I think, every 2 months. And we got time, I think, for one more article in this, Ryan, and it's about the Neanderthals, another piece of information about Neanderthals that are really fully human. They always have been. If you saw a Neanderthal today, you wouldn't be able to distinguish him from another human because they were, guess what? They were fully human. Well, so here's some more scientific evidence about Neanderthals being human.
You know, real quick, I do think you can distinguish a Neanderthal from a human today, because you have creationists and evolutionists, and I'll let the audience be the judge.
That's bad. You know, it's kind of like how they think the original atmosphere was all carbon dioxide. Well, they're breathing so much of it now with, you know, wearing masks all the time, like when they're out in their cars or they're walking around or jogging. I mean, you know, the amount of carbon dioxide they're breathing in is not helpful. In fact, NASA commissioned a long study, and masks cause twice as much carbon dioxide. In fact, triple the amount if you're walking, and who knows how much if you're running or on a treadmill. But anyways, that's going off on another topic. So what does this article have to say about Neanderthals, Ryan?
Yeah, so it basically goes into talking about footprints that were from children of these supposed Neanderthals, but really just regular human beings. And I can read an excerpt from the second paragraph. It says, "The prints with their distinctive human foot form are not in straight lines, so it was not likely a migration or a passage path. The children's footprints especially are somewhat chaotic." Lead author Eduardo Mayoral said this would indicate they were playing or loitering on the shore. There was no confirming evidence such as fossil bones that the footprints were created by Neanderthals. However, evolutionists say that Homo sapiens only arrived in the area 80,000 years ago, so they called them Neanderthal prints by default just to fit into their worldview and their ideas without any actual evidence to support it.
Yeah, and the article goes on to say that these are not the oldest human footprints. The famous Laetoli prints are dated at 3.6 million years old, and more recently, prints in Crete at 5.7 million years. In fact, we're talking about, doing a show on that. Evolutionists admit both sets are distinctly human-like, but the dates are way too old. They're, because they're supposed to be still ape-like. So they claim the prints must have been made by ape-like human ancestors solely because of the dating. They're ignoring the obvious evidence that these are clearly human footprints that don't fit in with their timeline. So they just have to assume, well, these are made from some chimp-like or ape-like human ancestor. It just doesn't fit their paradigm. So like Bill Nye said in his debate, oh, there's no out-of-place fossils. There's tons of out-of-place fossils, and yet this is yet another example. There's lots of them. So Bill Nye said something to the effect that there's no out-of-place fossils. We have tons of them, many examples. This is yet another one. And we've actually got a really good page at rsr.org/list of missing transitional fossils. So just do a search for fossils at rsr.org. We did a show on this back in 2014. It's one of our list shows, List of Missing Transitional Fossils. And Ryan, it's been a great honor to have you do the show. I'd love to have you do another one of these. Maybe, I think Creation Magazine, it comes out every 2 months. Maybe next time it comes out, we'll go through these focus articles again.
Yeah, this has been awesome. Thanks for having me on. I'd love to do it again and run it back.
All right. So we've got many great shows coming up. In fact, we're going to take on some ex-Jehovah Witnesses that are atheists that are really promoting views of why they believe evolution is true. And there's this one guy, he's got a super popular YouTube video, and we're going to go piece by piece through his video and refute his arguments. I'm really looking forward to that. We've got many other shows, great shows planned. We'd love you to help our ministry. You can go to rsr.org/store, lots of great materials, and help us stay on the air. We really need that help because the radio station doesn't pay us. We have to pay them to continue to broadcast from KLTT. It's AM 670, and it's 50,000 watts, and it's a huge radius of people that get to listen to the show. And also, Ryan, you'd mentioned this. The younger generation, they love to listen to the show on podcast and Spotify, things like that. Something your dad isn't super familiar with.
Well, I given just go, that you said podcasts and Spotify, probably not the most familiar. but this one, RSR's podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. So give us a listen on there.
Yeah, that's awesome, Ryan. I just go to the website if I miss a show. There's great shows during the week too. Don Vignart does a really good show during the week that kind of covers news events from a biblical perspective. And Doug McBurney also does this Monday through Wednesday. They do these great news shows. And Theology Thursday, that's sermons from Bob Vignart that are just fantastic. And I listen to those by simply going to the website and I find them there. I go to rsr.org and you can go to kgov.com also to listen to those shows. Or if you're driving on the road on Friday, AM 670 at 3 p.m. every Friday. So, for Fred Williams and Ryan Williams, this is Real Science Radio. May God bless you.